It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, small hospitals and clinics in America's rural areas are bracing for a surge in COVID-19 patients. We'll find out why some health experts are particularly concerned about risks facing people in those communities. First, a lot of us are spending more time at home these days, possibly more time alone, and we might be turning to music to help keep us company. There are a lot of things music can do for us during uncertain times, give us hope, calm us down, or just help us take a break from the news and thinking about the news. Our colleagues in the WPR Music Department put together a group about during our current moment. We'll be hearing some of those selections in just a bit. And we want to hear from you. If you have more time lately to listen to music these days, what are you turning to and why? What do you look for in your music choices these days? Tranquility? Energy? Hope? Let us know. This is a new number for us here. We're trying today, 800-228-5615. That number is 800-228-5615. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host. She's with us to share some of those selections. Lori, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Feels a little weird not to be talking about food right now.
Definitely. Lori. But let's start with the music anyway. Now, you and the rest of the WPR music team, you're sharing music all the time. What inspired the gang over there to put together this list of music you think is well-suited for this moment?
From time to time, we do a group blog post where we take a topic or a particular idea that music can express, or sometimes just pick a piece of music, say, for a specific holiday. And all of us will say, you know, this is what I think of when I think of American music, or this is what I think of when I think of something uplifting. We're sitting around in a meeting talking about what is it we need to be doing with our music programming. Should we be picking music that's quiet, or do we need to have more music that's energetic? And from there, we decided to put together this blog post where we all contributed something that we find helpful in this time. And we came up with a pretty eclectic list. And as I'm looking at the Ideas Network Facebook page where you posed the question earlier today, what do you want to listen to? It sounds like Wisconsin public radio listeners are just as eclectic, if not more so.
Well, before we get into some specific suggestions, Lori, what kind of things? I know you are a person who likes to, you know, talk to people. What kind of things are you hearing from, you know, your friends and community members and listeners, for that matter, about what they're liking these days?
Well, I've been part of the Milwaukee Symphony Chorus family since the mid-80s, and a lot of my friends who sing are really hoping to hear a lot of singing right now. One of my friends on Facebook said, we need human connections, and vocal music provides that. People I'm talking to want to hear energizing pieces. One person I know who is a very kind and wise pastor in his daily life admitted on Facebook last week that he really likes Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. So I actually put that on my playlist for a week from today. And what I'm going to suggest is that if people want to find things that are appropriate to use indoors to play the canons, whether it's a burst paper bag or a couple of pot lids you bang together, I'm hoping that next Monday after 2 o'clock, all of Wisconsin gets to join in and be part of a virtual orchestra of Tchaikovsky's 1812.
Well, let's be careful, people. Don't fire up your actual cannons during the 1812
Overture. No.
Safety first.
I want indoor appropriate artillery. So
right, well,
for me, that's definitely banging my pot lids together.
That sounds very safe. Well, Lori, let's get to some of the recommendations from our music gang. Stephanie Elkins had one. We'll take a listen to Bach's Italian Concerto. It's a harp here. Let's give a listen. Now, I know for Stephanie, she wrote that harp is her comfort food, Lori. Can you talk about this one a little?
What Stephanie brought up on our blog post was Milwaukee-born Victoria Drake, who is a harpist. And so she started off with Drake's recording called Scarlatti's Harp. Scarlatti keyboard music is incredibly intricate, and it sounds amazing on a harp. Harp has this incredible sound. It can be obviously percussive because you are plucking those strings. You are actually hitting them, if you will. But, of course, harp also has this incredible wash of sound that for many people is incredibly soothing. Very easy to dream when there's a harp on.
We're talking to WPR music host Lori Skelton about inspiring music for difficult times or comforting music, whatever you want. You could join in at 800-642. No, we're using a different number today. 800-228-5615. Again, 800-228-5615. What music do you find yourself turning to lately? Well, getting back to our WPR music list, Peter Bryant, our news and classical music director, suggested Vaughan Williams, his Symphony No. 5. Before we listen, tell us a little bit about the history of this one, Lori. Do we have you there, Lori? I heard a disconnect single. Well, Michelle at the board, let's hear a little of Vaughan Williams' Symphony No. 5 in the meantime while we get Lori back. Well, some inspiring music while we seek our guest, Lori Skelton, our own classical music host, Lori Skelton. She is sharing some inspiring music from our classical music department, music we can turn to in a difficult time. How about you? What are you listening to these days? Is there music you turn to for comfort, for inspiration, for some noise, maybe to drown out the thinking for a little bit? That's kind of the direction I tend to go myself. We want to hear from you. And if you're a regular caller, hey, there's a different number. Don't auto dial. 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Join in with the music that you are turning to in difficult times. Again, 800-228-5615, or join the list on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got some suggestions there as well. Patty writes, Leonard Cohen, you've got me singing an anthem in particular. Amy on Facebook turns to The Who, Magic Bus, and Baba O'Reilly will pull me out of the blues. Some good air drumming there, if nothing else. What's yours? Call in at 800-228-5615. We'll pick up the conversation. Hope to hear from you. That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with WPR music host Lori Skelton about what we listen to while we're possibly spending more time and alone, at home and alone. And you can join in at 800-228-5615. What are you listening to these days? Are you worried about what's going on out in the world? Is there something you turn to for comfort or distraction when it comes to music? Hey, if you're a musician, what have you been working on your own self? Call 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Lori, we heard a little Vaughan Williams there. Let's move on to your selection here, Lori. Before we listen, tell us what you chose to share with the list and the rest of us.
I am fascinated by music written for solo strings. And for many people, that's the Bach solo cello suites. Just one performer, this long line of melody always moving forward with harmony that's just hinted at. And for me, that's a really good kind of music to focus with. It was my favorite thing to study to when I was in college. And I find it very, for want of a better word, grounding. So I picked a 20th century version of what to play on a solo violin. A Belgian composer virtuoso named Eugène Ysaÿe wrote 6 short solo sonatas in 1923. He was inspired by Bach's music, but he did write them for 20th century ears. And the one I picked happens to have the Spanish habanera in it. So at the one part of it, you're focusing with your brain, but on the other part, your brain is dancing.
All right, well, let's get our brains dancing with a listen to that one. That one, Lori. That's good stuff. Well, I want to bring Lori our callers in now. We'll start with Jeff in Wausau on the line with us. Jeff, hello.
Hello, hello. Thank you.
Hi. What'd you want to share with us, Jeff?
If you've rediscovered any old iPods laying around the house like we have here, you know, any forgotten collections of really good music. You know, this one we found has some Strauss on it, but otherwise it's a lot of more modern stuff. But what have you unearthed?
That's fantastic, Jeff. I have done a little bit of that. I never really got rid of my iPod. I've got a lot of stuff on one, and I flipped through and found some old Sisters of Mercy and a little Nick Drake on mine. That's great comfort listening while I'm cooking. Lori, have you found an old iPod or other medium where you've rediscovered some music?
Not on the iPod, but I found myself listening to music from the 70s because that's when I was a kid. And I find it kind of comforting to put myself in a mindset back when I didn't have to worry about too much, which means guilty pleasure. I've been listening to a lot of the Partridge Family.
Nice. What are you so afraid of? That's a key line from Partridge Family, right? That's inspiring.
And who doesn't need to hear, I think I love you right
exactly.
now?
Exactly.
I love you, man.
Thanks a lot, Jeff, for the call. Let's go back to the list now from WPR. Our own Jonathan Overby, host of Higher Ground on Saturday nights. I love this selection. I want to give a listen. The song Bridge Over Troubled Water, the Aretha Franklin version. Here it is. Well, that's a perfect choice for this time, Lori, isn't it?
Oh, you want me to talk after that?
I want you to sing now, Lori.
Again, the power of the human voice, the emotion, and of course, just so beautifully brought together. That's not just yelling. There's huge technique that goes into singing like that. But when you can sing like that, and not have to worry about the technique, how can you not move anyone who's listening?
That's fantastic. We can find that list online, by the way, at wpr.org/music. Get some great musical inspiration there. We're talking to WPR classical music host Lori Skelton about good musical inspiration for a difficult time, maybe a time when we're spending a lot of our time at home. You can still join in at a special number now. That number is 800-228-5615. Again, 800-228-5615. Well, let's go over to our folk music department here. Dan Robinson, host of Simply Folk, chipped in this song, the group We Banjo 3, called We Need More Kindness in the World. Here's a little bit of that one.
In this world, we all need more kindness in this world. Well, you can look high or low, but there's no place else to go. We all need more kindness in this world. We all need more loving in this world. We all need more loving in this world. Well, you can look high or low, but there's no place else to go.
All right, Lori, do you find yourself wanting something really upbeat with a positive message like that?
Always. My dad loved banjo music. And so when I saw that on as Dan's selection, it just made me smile. Of course it's upbeat. And again, you know, it gives you that element of if I need to get up away from the conference call and dance a little bit, it's fantastic. Absolutely cheerful. Nothing wrong with being cheerful in the midst of all of this.
Let's go back to our callers now. Corey is with us in Milwaukee. Corey, hello.
Hello.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about, Corey?
Yeah, I'm digging the topic about the music that calms you, and I have quite a record collection that I unfortunately got posthumously when a dear friend of mine passed away, but it goes everywhere. Albert Collins to Led Zeppelin, Willie Nelson, Flatten Scruggs, Kenny Rogers. It's whoa, all over. Bob Marley. Yeah, I've
got.
That's
great.
It's a very dear collection that I am very enamored of.
Well, I want to ask you, Corey, I mean, yeah, it is sad how you got it, but do you feel a connection with your late friend when you listen to the collection?
Oh, hell yeah. Sorry
Excellent.
If that's not
that's,
a good word.
That's
but...
league. I'm going to, judges, we're going to allow that. Corey, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. That, you know, Lori, music that can help us feel connected to people. Because, you know, a lot of times we're listening together in a group with people or maybe performing together. Corey has found
Makes
a way to feel
better.
Connection. That thanks
yeah.
a lot, Corey. Corey, that kind of music gives us a connection.
Obviously, for those of us who do perform, we are missing our rehearsals. We are missing being in a concert hall. We are missing having that connection to one another, let alone connecting to an audience. But that is what we can draw on, even if we are listening alone. And even if that performing is just sitting around with your family singing at a birthday party. There is an amazing connection that happens through music. Supposedly, when we come to the end of our lives, the last of our five senses to leave us is our ability to hear. So, yes, we want to have beautiful things to look at. And yes, we have a connection to great past memories when we recreate a good meal. But ultimately, it comes down to what is coming through our ears that helps keep us alive and connected to the things that keep us alive.
Thanks for that that call, Corey. We'll go now to John with us in Fitchburg. John, hi.
Hi, Lee. Hey, very much appreciate this show. Lori, how about the introduction to Lohengrin?
Ooh. I will be honest. Not everybody likes Wagner. That's big orchestra. That's long lines that sometimes never seem to end. Having said that, I'm having to miss going to see The Ring in Chicago this month. So there are times when Wagner can be incredibly powerful. It's incredibly dig deep kind of music. So if you want to hear Lohengrin, go for it. It's powerful.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot for that suggestion. I want to give a listen to a little John Williams now. This is a suggestion from our own Ruth Ann Bessman. This one from Harry Potter and The Prisoner of Azkaban. Here's a listen to that one of many great John Williams soundtracks.
Thank you.
All right, Lori, we can't escape to the movie theater, but we can get some movie music to help us escape a little bit.
Ruth Ann's daughter is in New York City. So Ruth Ann asked her daughter what is making her feel inspired as she's dealing with a landscape that's changing by the hour. And Buckbeak's Flight from Harry Potter, as well as the Lord of the Rings music from Howard Shore, again, stretch the imagination. Give yourself as much room to roam in your mind as you possibly can. And those are two amazing movie soundtracks to enjoy.
Fantastic. We're going to go out, by the way, with that, a little bit of the Lord of the Rings there. But Lori, I know you're, as you mentioned earlier, a performer. I'm, you know, going a little nuts not being able to get out and play with the guys. Are you finding ways to perform at least around the house?
Oh, I'm singing around the house constantly. I'm finding there are certain things that my cats do not like. So I'm trying to avoid the things that are sending my cats hiding under the bed. But I've said this on the morning show a little over a week ago. I love singing Rossini's Largo al Factotum, the Figaro, Figaro. It's a great way to get your lungs working. It's a great way to say, I can handle this.
That is a fantastic note to end it on, Lori. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Lori Skelton, WPR classical music host. She was with us to talk about how music can get us through challenging times and to share some suggestions from our own music department. You can find that great list of suggestions at WPR.org/music. Another one on the list, as we mentioned, the Lord of the Rings Suite by Howard Shore. So we'll go out with that. And coming up, we'll take a look at health in rural areas and the threat of the coronavirus there. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many people are following advice to stay at home right now, but despite urgings from public health officials, some continue to ignore guidance to practice social distancing. We'll find out how a tendency known in psychology as the optimistic bias may be part of the problem. First, according to Johns Hopkins University, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. is approaching 340,000, with the death toll now topping 10,000. Roughly 18,000 people have recovered. So far, the most prominent outbreaks have occurred in high population centers like New York, Detroit, New Orleans, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. But there are growing concerns about rural areas where health experts say small and sometimes underfunded hospitals could quickly be overrun. They also say the rate of severe and critical cases could be higher than in bigger cities. John Ike is the director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, when we look at the incidents here in Wisconsin, it looks so far like rural areas haven't been hit super hard. Do I have that right? And what are we watching there?
Well, yes. I mean, the population centers are going to get it sooner and they're going to get it harder. One of the first cases was way up near Lake Superior. I won't say which county because it certainly is getting there. I know I just read something about Dodge County has started to address this differently because they're in the stage of community transmission. I think you're seeing that in different rural areas. It's like a tidal wave. You know, it comes from the coast and it's coming in. It's funneling through Chicago and Milwaukee and Madison. But it's viral and it's going to get to most places. It's just a matter of timing.
Right. We're seeing national reporting in some states. They're seeing per capita some very high levels in rural areas, not here in Wisconsin, but I guess not yet is the key phrase. How prepared are medical facilities in rural Wisconsin to deal with a COVID-19 outbreak if and when it comes?
Well, you know, in one sense, because this timing is delayed, they're over prepared. In other words, what we did as a country is say, let's stop elective procedures and surgeries in hospitals, which is an economic hardship for rural hospitals, in that they are, you know, that's oftentimes half of their revenue. And so they had to do that. And so they have staff waiting for the surge that's coming. These orders are made with the population centers in mind. But there's a bit of a disconnect because folks in rural areas hear the news of this coming. They feel the economic impact. They feel the impact to their hospitals, who some of whom are having to furlough employees while they're waiting for a surge to come, and yet they don't feel that they don't see the cases as quickly around them. So that can be difficult. So I would say, like I said, they're a little overprepared when it happens. I'm sure it depends. It's a community by community thing that happens. If it gets into a community and it happens to get to a place like a nursing home where you'll have several cases crop up all at once, that is going to overwhelm the resources. But frankly, our communities are really good at helping each other out.
What do we know about the demographics of rural Wisconsin that might play into whether people are more or less vulnerable, given what we know about the novel coronavirus?
Well, in general, by the data, rural demographics are older. They tend to be a little sicker and poorer than most cities and suburban areas. Obviously, that's not true across the board, but if you add up the numbers, that's what you get. And so for those reasons, not to mention the fact that they have greater distance to travel to care, they're going to be harder hit by these. Older folks tend to be more vulnerable to this, those with underlying conditions as well. Both of those play into the rural vulnerabilities.
And you just mentioned the time it might take to go and get care, say, at a hospital. What is the situation like, in especially in rural parts of the state that aren't close to a larger community? Do we have gaps, in effect, in our hospital resources?
I would say for the most part, we are pretty well positioned. There are gaps in care, but it tends to be where we have large forested areas. When we do the analysis on the mapping, it's about 98% of folks of residents are within 30 minutes of care. I think it's 96% are within 20 minutes. So for the most part, we're fairly well positioned, but it's just another thing. If you happen to be that 20 or 30 minutes away, and this moves fast when it gets serious. And so if you need to get to care and you have to find a ride first, that will also play into it. Also, we have to look at rural EMS systems. A lot of rural EMS systems are volunteer-based, and so they're having to scramble. You have services that may only have 50 to 100 calls a year, and they're oftentimes just able to handle those barely. And so now if you add a bunch of COVID patients on top of that, that's also going to be an extreme pain point, especially if you have a service where it may only be 5 to 10 core members doing all the calls. If one or two of them catch the virus, or they have been exposed and they need to be quarantined, that really will play havoc with rural systems.
Talking to John Eich, director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, looking at preparedness in rural Wisconsin when it comes to COVID-19. John, I've seen reporting again at the national level as everyone is scrambling to get key supplies. I've seen statements along the lines of, okay, if you're a manufacturer and you've got a state placing an order for 100,000 masks and you've got a big hospital placing an order for 10,000 masks, that little rural hospital that's trying to get in with their order for 1,000 or 2,000, they may not jump to the front of the line. Are we seeing that kind of logistical problem with just getting the foot in the door and placing orders for necessary protective gear?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've clearly seen that logistics are a big problem, no matter what level, whether it's from the federal response, and then that thereby putting a lot of pressure on the state response. The state's doing their best. They are, you know, getting shipments from the national stockpile. They are trying to distribute. But you have to think, if you're a small service or a small hospital in a rural area, that if there's a line for masks or other PPE, you're more likely to be towards the end of it. People so far have generally have what they need, but they still need more. And I would say, again, EMS is one of those, is one of the areas where it's needed the most. And because these are the folks that have to put those masks on every time they pick anyone up, because they could be COVID positive, because it's asymptomatic often. So, yeah.
And John, I want to look at what appears to be an effective part of our toolkit. We're seeing some states and some countries reporting that even if things were bad, a few weeks after they take strict safer at home or stay at home orders, whatever they call them, it seems to be bending the curve in the direction we want it to bend. Do you see the message getting out in rural Wisconsin that, hey, you may not see the disease yet, but taking action now is going to help us out in 2-3 weeks?
Yeah, I think that brings us back to that disconnect. A lot of the media is talking about what's going on in the sort of the hot spots and in urban centers. And yet when folks look around them in rural areas, they don't see the number of cases. They don't see the impact. And so that's difficult. It's difficult to say, well, you know, hold on. Hold on in that difficult position, because it may be weeks, but eventually it'll happen and it'll help everybody. It's not human nature necessarily to look so far ahead. Some people are good at it and most are not. So I think people are doing their best and certainly trying everything they can to do the right thing. But it's natural that we won't see it as obviously everywhere as we will in an urban area where you can look around and hear the sirens and know the cases.
John, you mentioned the difficulties in coordinating logistics, even at the national level. But here in Wisconsin, what kind of efforts are there to help rural healthcare providers brace themselves for this?
Well, as a matter of fact, there is a federal agency, the Health Resources and Services Administration. It does most of the funding for our office. They just released funding for rural hospitals, and our office is in the middle of distributing that. It's going to be roughly, they're estimating right now, the check hasn't been signed from the feds yet, but it's about $90,000 per hospital, and it'll be for about 64 rural hospitals around the state. It's a sizable chunk of money. It comes from the Federal CARES Act, but it will be welcome relief indeed, as I said, since these hospitals have to be, have reduced their revenue significantly in order to prepare for this.
And as we wrap up, John, with the coronavirus again, the news anyway, focusing on urban areas, a last thought on what rural communities can do right now to help prepare.
I think the same thing we're asking everyone to do, and that is as much as possible to stay at home, to keep social distancing, wash your hands a million times. So thanks for everything that everyone is doing in that.
John, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. You take care.
You too. That's John Eich, director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. We talked to him about the COVID-19 threat in rural parts of the state. Coming up, optimism can be a good thing, except for when it isn't. A psychologist tells us how a built-in optimistic bias can lead us to underestimate the impact of bad situations like the novel coronavirus outbreak. Find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, Governor Evers today moved to suspend in-person voting for what was supposed to be tomorrow's statewide spring election, but Republican legislative leadership says they're immediately challenging the move in the state Supreme Court. We'll break down the latest. First, public health officials have been warning for months that social distancing is key if we want to reduce the number of people getting sick with coronavirus. Despite that, some across the country have ignored that advice, leading to crowds on beaches, parks, and elsewhere. Our next guest says that psychology might help explain why, specifically something she studied called the optimistic bias. Marie Helwig-Larsen is a professor of psychology at Dickinson College. Her latest piece for The Conversation is titled, In Battling the Coronavirus, Will Optimistic Bias Be Our Undoing? Marie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, can you explain this concept of the optimistic bias?
Yes, I have studied this concept for over 30 years, and it essentially just refers to when people see themselves as less susceptible to risk than others. So, for example, we think that we're less at risk than other people of having a stroke, getting injured in a car accident, or getting divorced. And even people who might think that their behavior is somewhat dangerous, like smokers do, they still think that they're less at risk than other smokers, for example, of getting lung cancer. So we're kind of seeing the same thing actually with the coronavirus. So I was impressed to find that there's already research out there on what people think about their risk of the coronavirus. And there was just a study before the outbreak. So it was in before the outbreak was very serious, with 4,000 Europeans. And they were asked what they thought their risk was of personally getting infected. And then they were asked what they thought the chance was of someone in their country, an average person, was to get infected. And half of the people thought that they were less likely than other people in their own country to get infected. And actually only 5% were pessimistically biased and thought that they were more likely to get infected. So it's really very common, and we are seeing that with the coronavirus as well.
I guess the key is this optimistic bias strong enough that it keeps people from taking action? If I really think I'm not at risk, do I ignore those suggestions or orders to you know, avoid that close personal contact?
For sure. So there's actually quite a bit of research in general showing that how people view their risk, personal risk, affect their behaviors. So this is true in smoking. Smokers who think that they are less at risk of having negative consequences, also less interested in quitting, which doesn't seem surprising. And actually, there was a study, again, with coronavirus, but same results from an earlier study of the H1N1 virus. And both of them showed that the more people thought they were not at risk, the less hand washing they did, the less social distancing, and fewer other precautions they took as seemingly as a result of not thinking that they were personally at risk.
Now, optimistic bias sounds like a good thing. I mean, is there an upside to us as humans having this default optimistic mode?
For sure. So the research generally shows that having an optimistic outlook is good. It helps us feel less worried. It makes us feel in control. And those are definitely good things. So the tricky part is that you should realize that you are at risk in a positive way. So what does that actually look like? That might seem opposite. So one perspective is to not underestimate your risk and undertake precautions. But you could also not perhaps focus so much on what you think your own risk is, but instead think about the positive consequences of you taking precautions that don't have to do with you not getting sick. So by taking precautions, you're also protecting all the vulnerable people in your community, grandparents and people who have other health diseases. And you're also protecting our healthcare system and perhaps even our economy. So instead of perhaps focusing so much on you not being at risk, think about how you are helping many other aspects by engaging in social distancing and washing your hands.
Marie Helwig-Larsen is with us, professor of psychology at Dickinson College. She's talking about what's called the optimistic bias and why it may lead us to overestimate our chances of not catching disease, underestimate the risk, I guess would be a better way of putting it, and how it affects our personal actions. So, Marie, what you're just talking about there, is that a better messaging strategy to overcome the optimistic bias? Say, instead of saying protect yourself from getting sick, it's take these actions to protect people who are really vulnerable from getting sick.
Exactly. And I actually found similar findings in my smoking research. So smokers who thought that them quitting smoking would reduce the risk to other people of their smoking were particularly motivated to quit. So thinking outside of your own vulnerability can be generally effective. And it can also maybe disrupt some of this risk minimization that we see commonly in many different types of risk, but particularly when there's a lot of uncertainty. So the more uncertainty as there is right now about what actually causes the coronavirus and how it's transmitted can lead you to believe that you are uniquely invulnerable, which you may or may not be, but then instead think about other people.
Anecdotally, now I haven't done research on this, maybe there's some communications people who do, but I feel like that's a lot of the messaging I've been hearing on coronavirus. It isn't so much, hey, you should be scared, you're going to get sick. It's, here's how to protect you, your family, your community, your loved ones from getting sick. Just from what you've seen just on the street in your own media consumption, do you see that that's been a message that's been out there?
Absolutely. So I'm actually located in the UK right now, and part of the messaging here is to save the National Health Service. So specifically mentioning a structural aspect that's also under threat, namely the healthcare system. So that is part of the messaging. And then one might wonder why that's not working perfectly. So perhaps it's like other changes. People stick to what they're used to and sometimes have difficulty adjusting to and changing. So another strategy is perhaps to just think of some of these aspects as new habits. And new habits are hard, for sure. But probably every time you brush your teeth, you don't go, well, I am reducing my likelihood of having dental problems. So most people just brush their teeth, right? And they do it and they don't think so much about who they're protecting or how they're doing it because it's become a habit. So what's very challenging is that we're all trying to establish new habits. Clearly, it's not natural for us to keep other people 6 feet apart from us. And perhaps we're used to washing hands, but not as frequently. So trying to consciously establish new habits can then disrupt some of these issues about why you're doing it, because you should just do it all the time.
Does information and more exposure to information overcome our optimistic bias, like with coronavirus, when it was, okay, it's just this thing in China, or this thing in China, Iran, and Italy, or, well, it's on the coast, but it's not here. As it looms closer and closer, does that tend to knock us out of that optimistic bias?
Absolutely. And we're already seeing some of that in the research that's come out, is that even over a 5-day period in one study, people, in fact, did increase their beliefs about how risky it was for them. The tricky part is that they also increased the estimate of how risky it was for everyone else. So they were equally optimistic biased because they just increased their beliefs about everyone's risk going up. But there's a lot of research on personal experience, and it shows exactly what you're describing, is that the closer and more visceral the experiences are, the more you say, yeah, so maybe I'm not really immune, and it's not just the other people, and it's not just the old people, and it's not just people who did this and that and the other that put them at risk. So I would expect there to be more realistic approaches to preventive behaviors the more serious we see the outbreaks. The danger, of course, is that that is too late. So we need to work very hard before it's on our doorstep.
Very briefly, Marie, can we overcome this optimistic bias but not sink into anxiety, not overcorrect?
Yes. So the danger is actually not overreacting, but underreacting right now. So it's not good to be anxious, for sure. So I would say the strategy is to engage in the correct behavior and be hopeful.
We'll leave it there for now. Marie, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
We've been talking to Marie Helwig-Larsen, professor of psychology at Dickinson College. She was with us today to talk about what psychologists call the optimistic bias and how it could be affecting our collective response to the coronavirus. As she said, we tend to risk on something like a disease or smoking or anything like that. Love to hear from you about this. Has your thinking, your willingness to take action changed as this story and this disease has developed in the news? You could email ideas@WPR.org. Again, that's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know how your thinking has evolved in the last few weeks, last few days, and how it's changed the way you're taking action, if at all. And of course, you can keep following this quick moving story over at WPR.org/. The moon is going to look extra big tomorrow night, a great chance for some serious and convenient moon gazing. It's the pink moon. It won't actually look pink. It's named for seasonal flowers that bloom this time of year. It's also a supermoon. It only sort of has superpowers, though. A supermoon happens when you get a full moon at the perigee of the moon's orbit. That means the elliptical orbit is at its closest point to Earth. Well, what's in it for us? The moon is going to look extra big and shiny, especially when the moon is on the horizon. Then we get the bonus of an optical illusion that tricks our brains into thinking the moon is extra super big. Thanks, gullible brains. Even without the illusion, that supermoon is going to look about 14% bigger and 30% brighter than average. There's a downside, though. It looks like there's a good chance of rain and clouds tomorrow night for the southern half of the state. Superior, you are looking nice and clear, though. So if the rest of Wisconsin doesn't get to see this super pink moon tomorrow night, take some good pictures and send them along. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.